You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. This is part two of our conversation with Lauri Hakala on deliberate practice. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
So let's say I just finished a two-hour practice of full deliberate practice. What would I feel like as an athlete, and how would that be different than maybe a typical practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think when I read the research on deliberate practice, and I read the responses, the critics of deliberate practice, you know, it's an interesting dialogue, because sometimes I don't know. Again, I'm not a scientist. I'm a coach trying to sort this out like you guys. It seems people don't intuitively understand that deliberate practice is qualitatively different. And it's easy to create an illusion where everything looks like it's done deliberately. But even if one of the criteria that we discussed is not fulfilled, there may be no improvements. So for example, you could do a demanding task and you would have to keep pushing yourself outside the comfort zone, but if you don't get enough reps, you don't get better. If you're not fully focused, you don't get better. And so you can have 6-on-6 practice, and in one practice you physically strained yourself, but mentally you were not there. I don't know, you could be exhausted either way, but if your mind wasn't in it, you maybe didn't improve. And so Erickson, in actually, I don't know if it's published now. It was he sent me some articles that were that I think labeled 2019, but maybe they came out 2020, and kind of talking more about the things that he already mentioned in his book Peak, about purposeful practice and naive practice and maintenance practice and structured practice. And so maybe we don't have time to talk about all of them, but structured practice would be practice that there is a coach. There's structure to the practice. So there's an illusion that there is a practice that actually helps you improve. But some of the criteria may not still happen in that practice. So it looks like a 6-on-6 practice, but there's no specific task, or maybe there's no focus, or maybe there's no feedback mechanism, either from the coach or internally from the athlete. And I think a lot of the people that we label talented, which is a word that I don't use very often. In my language, it's the same as gifted. And it implies that you get something as a gift. And no doubt people will differ in their genetic makeup, but it's still, I think, the wrong way to look at trying to help people grow. Anyway, a lot of the people that we call talented may be the people that have, you know, better, maybe by happenstance, they're better at focusing, better at impulse control, which is, you know, you can direct your attention. Maybe there's a little bit of initial ability there that leads to great changes over time. And so initial ability doesn't highly correlate with final ability if there's a ton of deliberate practice in between those two states. And there's a really motivating message to get out there, because if something a small country like Finland needs is we need more people that we have in our pool of athletes in every sport that have the possibility, versus thinking, hey, we got to pick some, you know, key performers early in their careers. It's very hard to predict where people's careers will go. And I think this whole thing about how your athlete feel after deliberate practice or other type of practice is a great question, because we don't have an answer to that. It's this illusion is very persisting.
Yeah, it would be nice if you could walk out and have some, I don't know, thing that checked your wristband. Oh yeah, you had 2 hours of deliberate practice today, and good deal. Or no, you only got an hour and you wasted an hour. We'll have to figure that one out.
We do know that, you know, it's hard to pay attention. So although there are probably no fixed limits, Erickson has said that something like 4 hours for experts is quite a lot of deliberate practice, and a lot of novices can do mm-hmm. way less. Mm-hmm. And so part of the beauty of this thing is that although you need a lot of hours as well, obviously it's, you need less hours if the criteria are fulfilled, for sure.
Right. It's about the quality of it. So you had mentioned earlier the Pareto distribution, which is something I wasn't aware of. And maybe you can take us through and explain it for the other people who don't know what it is, and how volleyball coaches can implement the Pareto distribution.
Right. So of course I'm not a statistician or an expert in this field, either coach is trying to sort this out. And so the Pareto principle has many names. Some call it the law of the few, Price's law, after De Solla Price is one term for it, or the 80-20 principle. And it simply states that for many of real world's phenomena, most of the result comes from a tiny number of causes. And I think it's derivative of the Pareto distribution, a power law distribution. So if you look at some things in the world, they're distributed in a bell curve, you know, like IQ or height or some personality traits, which means that some people are on the high end and some people are on the low end, and then most of us are in the middle. But if we look at, for example, volleyball, how do you win a volleyball game? We know there's different aspects of the game you can train. You know, there's serving and passing and hitting and blocking and pancaking and covering and you can really go down to, you know, there's, you know, quite a few skills or areas even. But which one of those have the most impact on the outcome? And so the 80-20 principle, obviously the percentages are not always 80 and 20, but rather a small number can cause a lot of the result. And so volleyball coaches in the modern world, they know that you can be the best in digging and you can be the best in blocking, but if you can't serve, pass, or hit, it doesn't matter if you're the best in the world and in the others, because they don't hold as much weight. And so I guess that's what it is in short, you know, and it applies to many areas of the society. You know, most crimes are not committed evenly by people in the population. There's a very small number of people that commit almost all the crime, you know, and even the clothes Billy wears, I haven't seen in my video before, but let's say he has 100 items in his wardrobe and he probably doesn't wear them. If you have 100 days, if you have 100 days, it's not like every shirt gets one day. It's like certain clothes get worn more and so on. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really interesting way to look at the world.
Well, more like five items, but yeah, yeah. Five, for Billy.
And out of those five, one gets all the wear.
Right.
Yes, every day. Yeah. Right.
But so that's the principle. And then we'd have to keep in mind that when you're running an operation where you don't have the most resource and you can't be good at everything, you should be good at the key things. And then when you coach at a high level team that competes for Olympic medal, obviously the last bit of edge you can have, you should try to get. So everything is important, but when everything is important, like, you know, coaches in your network like to say there are no little things, but there's no problem with that, because I like the idea that when we fix a lot of little things, that's when the magic really happens. But you still have to see the forest from the trees. You can't start fixing all the little stuff and ignore the stuff that holds the most weight.
So yeah, it makes sense to prioritize the big parts of volleyball. And like I said, if it's an upper team, maybe you have more time to do everything. If you're, let's say, a high school team, like, how much time should you be spending on your pancakes and your jousts and some of the smaller things?
Yeah, I don't know exact amounts of time, but there are probably some thresholds. You know, there's a threshold for, let's say, defensive systems or defense. And once you're above the threshold where you're okay enough that you don't get hurt in that area. Mm. Like, I'm big on defenders being stopped, and I don't like to have too many schemes in place. For example, it's harder for the athletes to remember, and it's harder for them to do the stuff that really impact whether they get digged, which in my view are they standing in the positions, good starting positions, and are they mechanically sound and paying attention and all that stuff. So I don't know how much, but a little bit of practice time should be put there just so we are good enough that we don't get hurt. And I think that's a good way to look at many of these things.
That's a good way to put it. How's your life and your coaching changed since you you know, I know you now have a family. I think you have a 2-year-old. I know you were telling me when you coached it at Pepperdine with Marv Dunphy, you're in the office till 8 p.m. studying film, trying to figure out how you can help the team win in any little way you can. So I guess for coaches, how are you balancing all the things? And obviously you're well-versed and you're studying and learning, but you're also you know, trying to live a healthy life and be there for your family.
Right. So I remember vividly a night when it was something like 8 p.m. and the LA traffic had just began to quiet down, if it ever does. And I was in the locker room, and there's two baseball coaches there. Or maybe it was basketball coaches. And I was like, what are you guys doing in here? And we're talking about practice. And did you have families? And yeah, we do. And I was like, well, you know, that didn't sound too good because I had a girlfriend at the time, but I didn't have family, and I was free to, you know, learn from a great mind like Marv, or, you know, David Hunt was there, whom I greatly admire. And there wasn't a problem with it, but I realized that if I would continue this career this way, it would be very difficult to have a family life. And a lot of my mentors, like Carl and Marv and others, you know, that they say you can be only so good at so many things. And so you want to be a great father and a great coach, and maybe there's no room for anything else. And frankly, I see a lot of coaches, you know, I've been in a lot of meetings, and I haven't always been the most competent person in those meetings, actually quite the contrary. But the upside is I have been able to be in a lot of very diverse environments in many countries. And I see coaches do things that are not always productive for their lives. And one of the things, and maybe, you know, I get kicked out of some of the communities that I'm in when I say this, but I have become somewhat skeptical about watching film. And it's not because I don't think it improves. Obviously, there's a threshold. Probably, like, you have to watch a certain amount of your opponent, certain amount of your own team. But knowing everything about your own team when you actually can't change all of it is not in my interest if I also want to be a father, if I also want to work out, if I want to meditate, if I want to do any number of other things, read a lot of books that would help me advance in my career, or study, or do anything else. Or even if I want to be the best coach in the world, there's probably limits to what I should tolerate. Because film is a great devourer of time. You know, there are things we must do, some admin we have to do. We have to pay bills, recruit, and no doubt we have to work hard. But in the pool of coaches that I know and I've worked with, everybody works hard. This isn't, they're actually, you know, some people work harder. I thought I was the hardest working volleyball coach until I met Marvin David, of course, because I came from Finland. And so somebody who doesn't have to sleep like David, maybe they can work even harder. And maybe there's an advantage there. But for the rest of us, the mortals, I think a lot of people realize too late that they were not present with their kids. And so I actually grew to be more and more comfortable with not knowing as many things going into games when I knew that I had done enough. And I frankly think the results were better too. And I was a better father. So by doing a little bit less, still working hard, but doing a little bit less, maybe more quality, I think was the key. And it's in line with the Pareto principle. I know I've talked like 2 minutes straight now and really is falling asleep maybe there, but John,
no, I'm going to use that.
I'm in.
I think for me, the conditioning will be the 20% that I can skip. And you know, if I want to be,
no, I think it's a really good topic to talk about. I remember talking with Tom Black. It's not fair. He's not here to defend himself, but he's one of the hardest workers I've seen. And he was telling me, oh yeah, you know, sleep's important for athletes. They need to recover. But for coaches, you know, you have to worry, you know, sleep's not important. You gotta, you know, there's not enough time in the day to get everything done. So you gotta stay up. And I remember thinking like, no, like I want to be sharp. I want to be focused. I want to be locked in as a coach. And if I don't get enough sleep, then I'm not going to be at my highest level. So I guess there's that balance of, yeah, I want to study the film. I want to know them, but I also got to take care of myself. So I think it's a good thing for coaches to be aware of and thinking about, and yeah, maybe taking that Pareto principle into our decisions we're making as coaches as well.
Right. I guess one more thing I'd like to add. A couple of years ago, I went to see Fred Sturm in Denmark. And so Fred Sturm was the head coach for USA in the 90s and an associate to a lot of the coaches that we've talked about now. And one of the things that he said that really stuck with me was these great coaches have found a way to work that suits them. And there are coaches that differ in their, you know, skill set. You know, if you're a former statistician, you know, a data volley guy, and if you don't need as much sleep and that's your passion, it makes you really happy. Like, there's no judging that, you know. I actually quite admired the people that have the stamina. But for myself, I need a little bit more sleep. And it's just like you said, I can't make fresh decisions. And even if I can make decisions, but if I'm so tired that I'm nauseous, then I'm actually not enjoying it as much. Mm. And there's a price you have to pay if you want to win. And so obviously, like, I work in a job where stakes are high, and and you know, results are expected and so on. And I have to have a clear mind to try to do good. And I can't do it if I spend time doing something else. So maybe it is for sure individual. For sure, I think coaches should watch film. They should work hard. But more than anything, they should find a way to coach that works for them and for their families. And ultimately, they would have to know what they want the most in life, because life is short. And it would be terrible to be, you know, on your deathbed and think, hey, man, I watched too much film and I didn't spend time with my daughter, you know. And I think a lot of us get there, grow older faster if we don't sleep, frankly. Some of us don't. Some people apparently need less sleep. But.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's back to just knowing yourself and knowing what you're like at your best. So then you can make sure you're doing the things to put yourself in that spot as a player, as a coach, as a human. So I want to go a little off topic. And I've heard this term, and I'm probably going to butcher it and say it wrong. Sisu? Sisu?
Sisu, yeah.
Sisu, what is it?
Yeah, I guess true grit is how you would put it in English. It doesn't have, it's like perseverance when all odds are against you and even worse. And it's a term, all I know, maybe it's an older Finnish word, but it originated during the World War II. Finland is the only country in the history of who ever stopped a full offense of the Soviet Union. And so in the winter war times, in those times when we were, first fighting the Soviets and then later towards the end of the war, fighting Soviets and Nazis. So that was, you know, it's part of our heritage to talk about those times and how difficult life was. And so Sisu was not giving up, basically, in a Finnish way. And the people who lived in that era were particularly tough because it was way more rural society back then. We were not as urban and comfortable as we were now. But
nice. And we have a couple of listener questions for you. So Junis H asks, who is the most fascinating
character? Say it again, Billy. we're working on our Finnish here.
Huhtikangas?
Jonas Huhtikangas.
Yeah, that's
it. Thank you. Billy said Junis.
No, is it? Anyways, JH wanted to know, who's the most fascinating character that you've met in the volleyball world and what made him or her so special?
Most fascinating character.
I know you just met John, but so he doesn't count.
No, we played against each other.
We played against each other, you know? But I just met you, so. Yeah, you know, maybe Lucas Labbé. Luca, an assistant coach for USA Women now, and he was a head coach for Slovenia. I was his assistant coach there, and he's like me. He's a small-sized European that came to the United States and then came back to Europe, and Carl. Many people liked Carl, and some maybe didn't, but Carl had, let's put it this way, he touched many lives, and he once told me that Luca is the greatest, and this was before I knew Luca, and he said something like, you know, because of certain characteristics, and so he's an underdog, and he has a golden heart, and he's really intense, and he doesn't take no for an answer. And I think he exemplified a lot of the things that I think a good coach is. And I think the fact that he can be so demanding and so warm, I think as coaches, we want to do good by our athletes and we want to involve them in the processes like we've talked about. And sometimes we get less demanding as we grow fonder of our athletes. And that's dangerous because if we want to be the best or if we want to improve, we have to be fond of people. We also have to know how to push people in a good way. And I think Luca, just in him, a lot of these characteristics come together. And so maybe that's my answer.
And what does push people in a good way look like to you?
Yeah, I guess one of the things you have to do is you have to be true to your own person. I think good coaches, this is one of the criteria of deliberate practice that doesn't happen, is that people don't get pushed outside their comfort zones, because ultimately people want to be liked. Certain people like want to be liked less than others. And it's a character trait in the Big Five continuum. You know, it's, you know, agreeableness, disagreeable people, they push people more, but you have to be able to create safety within the your circle of influence that the people make that the people feel safe before you can actually push them. But ultimately you have to tell them bluntly. You have to be really honest with them. And I think, I don't know if this is answering your question, but first create safety, then push people by talking to them. And then if things don't happen because of attitude, which actually happens more than we'd like to think, even at high levels, then you have to be able to tell people, hey, you're done for today in practice. See you tomorrow. You have to be able to kick people off the team if they don't behave properly. Look at it, just that in Slovenia with several world-class athletes, and gained a lot of my respect when he did that. And so there's ways to be blunt and honest and warm, and it's not easy, but good coaches do that.
Yeah, it's a hard skill. All right, so next one from now, I'm going to try to say is Hunas, Hunas H. He says, he's asking, what are three things that you value the most in life and why?
Yeah, easy questions.
Yeah.
You know, what we value is not what we say we value, it's how we act. It's how we act. I think that matters, and it matters a little bit what we say too, but mostly how we behave. And so I don't know if I live according to what I just say, but health. Most people have had some health issues, and you don't think about them until things are critical. Like right now in the world has dropped a lot of functions just to preserve health. So I would say health. I would say, well, probably I would lump together health and family, because it's you know, we talk about pretty general terms, but health and family, and then I think there's something about you know, Seneca, the philosopher, the Stoic. And he said something that he greatly valued the, how did it go? Valuing the friendship and courage of ordinary men. And there's something in that phrase that I really like, that if you're surrounded by people that are friends, they're courageous, and courage means that you speak your mind, and regardless of what position that puts you in. And I think there's something about those things that I value the most. And it's interesting then when you look at our jobs, like when we look deep down what we value the most, like their excellence, I value that too. But if you ask top three, maybe excellence is then third or pursuit thereof, after we have family and health covered. But so I don't know if that satisfies the listener question, but that's my makeshift answer.
Good answer.
Nice. And finally, what has better beaches, Finland or Hawaii?
Yeah. So for what purpose? I was just, before we started recording, I think I told you guys, I'm looking outside the window and there's fourth floor on a lake in a small town. And I can see it snowing upward. The wind is blowing from the beach, and it's picking up the snow and somehow against the wall, and then it's snowing upwards. And so I'm a patriot, and I would go for Finland in many, many things. And so I just want to say that Hawaii has better beaches, but just don't discount Finland. There's a lot of beauty here, and it's a little colder, and you can't maybe play beach in as many places, but it's nice.
I'm trying to picture that first semester you going from Finland to Hawaii, and I mean, what was that like? That must have been a crazy shock.
Yeah, it was different, to be sure. Canadian senior Jake Muse pulled me aside and said, hey, do you know you're walking three times the speed everybody else is walking on campus? And that wasn't the only cultural shock there, but
I bet
it was a good transition. It took me a year, but it was very nice.
Yeah, well, I actually haven't been to Finland, but I admire a lot of what I've read and learned about the way you guys do things, and definitely have always respected you, and yeah, just appreciate all the time, all the knowledge you shared today, and hoping we can continue to communicate and learn from each other, and I'm excited to see you develop the Olympic programs there with Finland. I'm sure there's going to be nothing but gold medals in 2021, right? That's the plan.
I appreciate your words, and likewise, I've been listening to your podcast for quite a while, and so it was an honor to get the invitation. It's really, really nice to talk to you guys.